I'm David Ford, and it's a special Triad Arts 4th of July weekend. Bethany Chafin will be back on the second half of the show with her interview of author Ken Ilgunas. He'll share a behind-the-scenes peek at his book Walden on Wheels, a memoir about student debt, adventure, and freedom. But before that, it's time for a poetry break with Ghanaian-born Jamaican poet Kwame Dawes. He's the award-winning author of 16 books of poetry, numerous works of fiction, nonfiction, criticism, and drama. The Chancellor's Professor of English at the University of Nebraska also teaches in the Pacific MFA Writing Program. Kwame's work has been performed at the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem. Hope it's been a happy July 4th weekend for you so far. We're sort of taking a laid-back approach to the holiday this year on Triad Arts Weekend with a nod to one of life's simple, quiet pleasures, curling up with a good book. No fireworks, no marching bands, just this.
How coolly it has broken you, trying to mask the knowing wit behind your eyes. Every smile brilliant against your gleaming black skin is defiance. You stammer, push out words, tell your story, slap your knees to show where your stroke-frozen body would crawl across the concrete to reach the yard with the gawking onlookers. You laugh. Man must live. Man must live. How casually broken. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what does it feel like when someone, a previous stranger, confides in you so much on such a personal level?
Wow, that's, it feels in one moment like a burden, and then it feels so liberating because in a sense, they're trusting you with their stories and their narratives and their experience. But you also know that it is a moment. And it's like getting a gift. Somebody gives you a gift, they're not giving you their whole life. They're giving you something that you make with it, what you can make with it. You honor that gift. And this support group of people allowed me to come and sit with them and just listen to them talk and answer my questions and let me laugh and they ask questions and so on. And this is a very closed support group that has been meeting and are helping each other, and they're honest and they're funny and they're outrageous and all of these things. But they let me sit with them. And that was the great drama, the great opening for me. And Nicole's body, you can see, is just completely sort of beaten up by the strokes he's had and by the damage of this disease. But the brilliant kind of smile on his face, and he, you would listen as he struggled to say the words. And then he said, man must live, Vaya, man must live. God, what a beautiful person. What a beautiful moment. And then all day and all night, it stays with you. And for weeks, it stays with you. And then you write the poem to recapture the moment. I remember we did a performance with this in Jamaica. Nicole was in the audience and, you know, he came to me afterwards and he laughed and he said, real good, man. Very nice. And I tell you, that means so much.
In your travels, what you've come to see in terms of people dealing differently with AIDS in Jamaica that you could speak to?
You know, the Jamaica is a very peculiar place, and it's you know there's a recent report that came out. We're number three in the world as the happiest people in the world, number three. And Jamaicans are just amused by it because anybody gets angry, they say, hey, remember we're number three, don't mess it up, you know. So we're looking to be number one. Well, the absurdity of this statement is that we are also the angriest people in the world. And they didn't do that stat, but it's the same thing. So those two sort of contradictory seeming things, those volatile dynamics, are part of the peculiar resilience and kind of toughness of the Jamaican people. And it is a phenomenon. There's a combination of arrogance, a kind of aggression, and yet a kind of energy for life and a kind of joy for life and so on. And I think it feeds in into how we deal with something like HIV. So in a positive way, it allows for people to survive through it. The negative side of it is that our capacity to be impatient and completely intolerant of difference, of the quality of homophobia, the ability to say to somebody that it's your fault that you're this way and so on, remains also high up there as well. So there are these elements that both allow survival and success and a way to live and love with the disease, and yet the same sort of qualities make it so rough for people to just get by day in the society, which is not a wealthy society. I mean, there's poverty in Jamaica, but it's also a place in which that struggle to make it through is almost a theme of the culture and the society, of the music and of the art and so on. I know my faith
is strong, but do Chancellor's professor of English at the University of Nebraska, poet and author Kwame Dawes. His work has been performed at the Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem, and you'll find links to Kwame's 2013 book of poetry on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Try at Arts Weekend. The book is Duppy Conqueror, New and Selected Poems. I'm David Ford, and there's more great poetry on the way, beginning with international award-winning poet Terry Kirby Erickson. Her fourth collection of poetry is A Lake of Light and Clouds, which received high praise from New York Times bestselling author Jill Connor Brown, who wrote that Terry, quote, makes us see everyday things with new eyes and gratitude that beauty is not the exception, but the rule of life.
This particular poem is called Loretta Ray. My mother, lipstick red, barefoot, toenails painted the palest shade of pink, stretched out her dancer's legs and rubbed suntan lotion into a face that should have been magnified on a movie screen, the kind that bowled men over even with curlers in her hair and children dangling from both hands wherever she went. They never saw the greasy chaise lounge behind our house, where the sun whispered sonnets in her ears and darkened her skin with hot kisses while the radio played Blue Velvet. And the greengrocer and the mailman and the gas station attendants and the jean-clad teenage boys loitering downtown on Saturday afternoons, who caught glimpses of Loretta Ray every now and then, if they were lucky, would have dropped dead with desire if they'd seen her sunning herself in our backyard, wearing nothing but a two-piece bathing suit and a lazy, sun-drenched grin. The best years of her life almost, but not quite, passed.
Loretta Ray by Terry Kirby Erickson. That from her new book of poetry, A Lake of Light and Clouds. I love that line. They never saw the greasy chaise lounge behind our house where the sun whispered sonnets in her ears and darkened her skin with hot kisses while the radio played Blue Velvet. Such a wonderful image, and not only does it take me to dreamland, it kind of shifts gears, it slows the pace down, too. Do you think much about rhythm or tempo in your poetry at all, or no?
I do, and after I write poems, I usually read them aloud. I do a lot of pacing and reading because I want to know how it sounds. I don't want there to be anything in the poem that people trip over so that they are out of the moment of the narrative. So I want to be sure that it's smooth and that I'm telling whatever story that I need to tell in a way that is musical and rhythmic.
I'm glad you said musical, because that line really hit me as and just the sounds of the word, the syllables and the vowels as they pair up in her ears and darken her skin with hot kisses. It just rolls off the tongue so nicely, and it does sound like a musical line.
My mother was always a gorgeous woman. She was homecoming queen in her high school. She was a majorette. She was a model, a ballet dancer. Really very beautiful. And she still is. You know, there are two parts of her life. There's this part, and then there's the moment in 1980 when my brother died. And so I kind of look at my mother's life as divided, just like mine is divided. And there was the time before that, and then the time after that. So any time that I write poetry about my mother, there's a certain poignancy to that.
I want to treat listeners to another of your poems, Terry, and this one, we're going to shift gears now, because this is a very serious subject matter, Leroy and Viola.
Come Saturday morning, poor black men gathered on street corners, waiting for white men in Cadillacs to drive by slow, shouting, "Hey, boy," from their rolled-down windows, "get in," which meant there was a job digging ditches or other back-breaking work for less money than it cost to feed the family dog. Nights were harder, what with hooded gangs of racists wrapped in bedsheets roaming the countryside, and woe to anybody who wasn't white once those half-drunk, hate-mongering mobs with their burning crosses and links of rope arrived on the scene. So in 1965, when married mother of five Viola Gregg Liuzzo volunteered to drive 19-year-old Leroy Moten back to Selma, both fresh from a freedom march in Montgomery, Alabama, the sight of a white woman with a black man in the front seat of a vehicle sporting Michigan plates didn't sit well with Klansmen who were, as usual, wild as pent-up ponies in a barn blaze. So they chased the pair down and fired two bullets into Liuzzo's brain, laughing like loons when the car careened into a ditch. Covered in blood, Moten played dead, surviving the shots, the crash, and the killer's swift perusal of the wreckage. But Viola Liuzzo is gone, except in memory, where the same reel runs over and over in Leroy Moten's mind. A pretty woman's profile, pale as milk against the purpling sky, and his hand, dark as rivers on the radio dial. Strangers joined forever by history, seconds before the slaughter.
Really powerful stuff, Terry. And before we get into the just kind of the poem as a whole, the line again, talking about sounds and combinations of words, is, and what a great image. Wild as pent-up ponies in a barn blaze. Great, great sounds, great image.
You know, again, it's with that rhythm and the music and the sound of it.
Well, describe what it took to get here. Pale as milk against the purpling sky and his hand dark as rivers on the radio dial. What did it take to get there? And just if you could describe the satisfaction of arriving at a powerful, we'll call it a metaphor like that.
Well, I worked very hard on this poem because it's a true story and it's an important story to tell. And I wanted to be clear and succinct and at the same time give readers a visual so that this was a real thing because, you know, I lived in that era of segregation and I was born in 1958. You know, I was a child in the 60s, but, you know, we saw little things here and there. And the part that I wrote about the cars driving by slow, looking for young black men to work, my grandfather used to do that, you know, not in a ugly or mean way. It's just how it was done. On Saturday, you would go drive downtown, and there were men on the street corner waiting and looking for work. And that's how it was done. And I never forgot that after someone told me. I can't remember. It may have been my dad. And so I wanted to use that.
Then you arrive at that specific turn of phrase and getting back into kind of the process of writing poetry. Mm-hmm. Just to give us a hint of the effort that it took to arrive at that particular group of, that one just struck me, much like the Blue Velvet reference did in your mother's poem, the color of the hand, the mm-hmm. the pale as milk hue to her skin. How did the process work?
Well, I was always moving toward that moment. That was a central image in my mind when I began the poem. So when I finally got there, trying to find the words so that people could see that in their mind's eye, the white skin of this woman and the black skin of the man, you know, to know that there were people around who thought that it was wrong and sinful and an abomination for them to even be in the same vehicle, when in fact, by this very act, these terrible murderers nailed these two people together for all eternity.
What great irony, horrific irony, but when you look at it through that lens, that's exactly what they did.
That's exactly what they did, because all this was a ride. She was just giving this young man a ride back from the march, as she had done for many people. So they created a couple out of them, in a sense, which is what they were railing against in the first place.
poet Terry Kirby Erickson. Her fourth collection of poetry is A Lake of Light and Clouds. Terry's also the author of In the Palms of Angels, winner of 3 international awards. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Bethany Chafin is back with a look at Walden on Wheels, a memoir about student debt, adventure, and freedom, just about 10 minutes from now. But first, more poetry. Bill Griffin is a family doctor and geriatrician living and working in rural North Carolina. Bill's poems have appeared in many regional and national journals, including Southern Poetry Review, Tar River Poetry, Poem, North Carolina Literary Review, and Pembroke Magazine. In 2009, he received the North Carolina Poetry Society's Poet Laureate Award.
All the times I've visited the zoo, you know, I've been struck by how it not only gives you a sense of the exotic, but also brings you right here home to the Piedmont, you know, because of the setting and because the displays bring the, you know, wild animals close to you. I had a close encounter of the herpetologic kind yesterday evening. I was coming back from a program, and right outside the Sonora Desert exhibit, they have a wonderful rock garden, and this black and white streaked lizard jumped up on a rock, and I thought, I've never seen one of those before. He looks like he escaped from the Sonora Desert, and we were actually just looking him up online, and he actually is a southeastern fence lizard, so he's native, but he sure looked like he belonged in that rock garden.
I'll bet. Well, your background is in medicine, family physician, and geriatrician in rural North Carolina, talking the Elkin area. Talk about that entree for you into then the world of poetry.
I had some very inspiring teachers in high school and college, and so I kept up with reading over the years, but never really did much writing until about, about 15 years ago, I took a workshop on reading contemporary poetry, and among the poets we read was A.R. Ammons, and I read the poem Hymn, which he uses a lot of scientific language to bring us not only close into the tiniest aspects of nature and creation, but also into the farthest reaches. And I thought, oh my gosh, science and poetry, they belong together.
You mentioned A.R. Ammons, and I can't think of a better kind of bridge between the world of science and poetry. Could you read a stanza or two from him?
He says, I know if I find you, I must go on out over the sea marshes and the Brant and Bay, over the canyons, crater lakes. And he keeps taking it out in the spiraling circles, you know, out into the atmosphere, out into space. And at the end he says, and I know if I find you, I will have to stay here with the separate leaves. So the sense I get from that is that to really discover the meaning in, within ourselves as well as the meaning of our place within our neighborhood, our habitat, our environment. It's not as if nature is out there and then where we live is something else. It's all part of one earth. Environmentalist from Africa, Baba Diom, said, in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We love only what we understand. We will understand only what we are taught. So the teaching aspect of us learning, you know, about the creatures and about the places they come from might inspire us to care for them to the point where we will conserve them, and by doing that, then we preserve ourselves.
Talk about how your art does bring about some innovative ways to communicate that message.
I think poetry can teach with a metaphor or with some really vivid image and slips right through the bars of your logical thinking and teach directly to your heart.
Well, you're no stranger to this world of bringing nature to the fore through poetry, and I'm referencing here the 2008 collaboration with your wife, Linda French Griffin, to create this book, Snake Den Ridge. That's out on March Street Press. I'm looking at this list of characters that you've sketched out here, squirrels, crayfish, salamanders. Could you pick one of those from the book and maybe treat us to one of those poems?
I like to read you one of my favorites, Salamander. You know, in the Smokies, each watershed has its own distinct salamander species. So each one of these poems, the creature is actually speaking directly to the reader in first person. So this is Salamander. This is my gift to change. From Inadu Creek, I leave behind my frilly gills and climb the spire of blue-eyed grass. Having become a creature of air, bathing myself in dew, am I not still a creature of water? I invite you to discover in each of my family our variations. Discern that every runnel, every spring, every palm-sized cup of moisture holds its lithe expectation. For this is my gift to you, to notice changes. I will let you lightly touch the welcome of my smoothness while I drink a little warmth from your hand. Now count the dapples down my length. Measure the blush of my cheek. Then find, when you descend the eastern face of Snake Den Ridge, those subtle alterations my cousins are accumulating until finally they acquire a new name. And when you have returned me to my bed of blue bead lily, then touch a smooth place within yourself and carry with you into the world your own changes.
Boy, that's really nice, Bill, on so many levels. I love the image there of climbing the spires of the blue-eyed grass and then petting the smoothness of the skin, sharing that with the warmth of the hand, and then it comes back at the end to really forge that collaboration.
Well, I would hope that, you know, each creature in speaking something from within itself kind of touches the reader to find something within themselves that's maybe new or different or something they hadn't been aware of. And all the poems in the book also have a little backstory of an encounter behind them. The salamander we ran across as we were hiking the trail up to Klingman's Dome, and he had climbed up a spire of grass, and there he was with his red cheek. It was Jordan's red-cheeked salamander.
Great.
Which only exists in the Smokies.
...2009 North Carolina Poetry Society Poet Laureate Award winner Bill Griffin. His poetry chapbook is Little Mouse, out on Main Street Rag. The collection of 32 poems, each poem 20 lines long, speaks to the many different struggles and epiphanies we all share as members of the human family. And you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Time for a short break, and then we're back with associate producer Bethany Chafin in a trip to Walden on Wheels with author Ken Ilgunas, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.